From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a knockdown debate, some levity from the candidates, and a plot, we're told, to bomb the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. At the Al Smith benefit dinner last night, the presidential candidates poked fun at each other and themselves. Here's President Obama.
As some of you may have noticed, I had a lot more energy in our second debate. I felt really well rested after the nice long nap I had in the first debate.
And here's teetotaling Mitt Romney on his prep for the debates.
Refrained from alcohol for 65 years before the debate. Second, find the biggest available straw man and then just mercilessly attack it. Big Bird didn't even see it coming.
And New York Police Commissioner Ray Kelly says a busted terror plot shows his city is still a big target.
We're still very much a coveted target by terrorists. He said New York is the top of the terrorist target list in this country, and I think this just reaffirms that.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of National Journal, Lisa Lehrer of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's unfolding in the home stretch of this presidential campaign? What do you see? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Chicago is Major Garrett, White House correspondent for the National Journal. Major, welcome back. Good to have you.
Hello, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Lisa Lehrer, politics reporter for Bloomberg News. Lisa Lehrer, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. We're all in the house.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Lisa.
Okay, let's listen to just a little bit. There was all fun and games last night, and boy, we enjoyed it and kind of needed it, but it was tough during the week. Here was President Obama in Mount Vernon, Iowa, on Wednesday, one day after the big presidential debate, said Mitt Romney's proposed economic policies just didn't make sense.
So let's recap what we learned last night. His tax plan doesn't add up. His jobs plan doesn't create jobs. His deficit reduction plan adds to the deficit.
So says the president. But the Governor Romney was looking at President Obama and saying next 4 years he comes up short on plans and vision.
Don't you think that it's time for him to finally put together a vision of what he'd do in the next 4 years if he were elected? He's got to come up with that over this weekend because there's only one debate left on Monday.
And that's coming right up. Lisa Lehrer, it was fun last night. It's been tough on the campaign trail. Where does this race stand?
Well, this is an extremely tight race. It's tightened from the first debate, and it's remained tight. And I think barring something really crazy in Monday night's foreign policy debate down in Florida, I think it's going to remain tight right until Election Day. And, you know, people have been talking about a scenario where Romney wins the popular vote by overperforming in southern states, and Obama wins the electoral vote by, you know, winning all the necessary battleground states. And if that happened, it could remain tight even after Election Day. That's, of course, the kind of scenario that political reporters like us love. It's maybe not so great for the country because it ends up being a bit of a mess. But I think the fact that people are even talking about that kind of thing happening in a race that where Obama for several months seems so far ahead is a sign of just how down to the wire this thing could go.
I mean, that really portrays it as a squeaker. Heaven help us if we're still wondering on the other side of the vote. Major, what about these polls, which are all over the place? We've got Gallup, a national poll showing Mitt Romney seven points up on the president, a bunch of others that go the other way, kind of a congregation in the middle. Is there a polling consensus or not here, Major?
Well, I think the polling consensus this year has been this is going to be a tight race. If you go back to the Gallup numbers from January, February, March, April, they had it around 49, 47, 49, 46. That pattern continued through the summer months, and it is now tighter now, 48, 49. That Gallup number has spread out a little bit. I will tell you, Republicans don't believe Mitt Romney's ahead by 7 points nationally, and I will tell you the Obama campaign doesn't care what the national polling data tells them. David Plouffe told us in no uncertain terms after the debate at Hofstra University, I don't care what national polls say. I care what state polls say, and I care what our analytics and what our contacts in the crucial states tell us. And David Plouffe also made it very clear, and I wrote about this earlier this week at nationaljournal.com, that the Obama campaign is building a firewall and circling its wagons around four states, where Jack is in New Hampshire, Ohio, Iowa, and Nevada. They believe they are ahead there, and what the remainder of their attention for the remainder of this campaign will be focused on is keeping the leads in all four of those states, because if they win all four, the scenario that Lisa just talked about, plausible though it will be, won't happen because they'll win.
even if Romney should take Florida, even if Romney should take Virginia, North Carolina, I don't know, Wisconsin.
Yeah, it'll be closer, but if the president holds Ohio, Nevada, Iowa, and New Hampshire, he wins.
And do you see this scenario, this possibility of something so close that we're still counting and clucking the day after the election, Major?
I can see a scenario which is very close. Chuck Todd and I have talked about this quite a bit at NBC. He did a 20 minutes on his show yesterday morning on the Daily Rundown about a 269 scenario on the Electoral College. Not implausible. But what we've also known in this race, and it's recent information and it's important, the first debate indicated that though the president's support was always numerically high, it was in some cases only lightly attached. People detached from the president after that first debate. And so you have to ask yourself, if that support in the 2 or 3 percentage point margin was that detachable after 90 minutes of presentation, you have to ask yourself how solid and motivated and enthusiastic that support is. And I will tell you, that's the biggest underlying concern the Obama campaign has. Enthusiasm, attachment to the president, and dedication to voting. And that's going to be the mechanistic side of their campaign from now until Election Day.
The president's saying vote, vote, vote everywhere he goes. Jack Beatty, what do your political antenna tell you? What do you see? What are you feeling with that sensitive array of receptors there, Jack?
Well, I think that the Obama campaign can look at that really for them desolating Gallup number and look in the internals and see some encouragement, namely that in the swing states, abortion is the number one issue for women. That's a big surprise, and it's number one by a considerable degree over the economy and other issues. That that's borne out that sense of that women's issues are now to the fore by the gender gap that's now seemingly strong again in Iowa, 18-point gender gap toward the Democrats, same in Wisconsin, and the voters who dropped away from Obama in that first debate seemed overwhelmingly to be women voters, and that gap was closing. Stan Greenberg especially found that among single women, there was just a feeling of almost despair about the president, and they were available to listen to Romney. These polling results suggest they're now not so available, and you can really see that both campaigns are going to now address this. The president to try to maximize his advantage there, and Mr. Romney to try to close that gender gap.
Lisa, I want to bring this one to you. There was that whole flap over Mitt Romney talking about his efforts to bring women into his cabinet when he was governor of Massachusetts. His wording, and maybe attitude, got a lot of attention. Here was that moment. He talked about the process of recruiting women in Massachusetts.
I said, well, gosh, can't we find some women that are also qualified? And so we took a concerted effort to go out and find women who had backgrounds that could be qualified to become members of our cabinet. I went to a number of women's groups and said, can you help us find folks? And they brought us whole binders full of women.
Whole binders full of women, that phrase all over the social media and the internet and the campaign trail. The next day, Mount Vernon, Iowa, President Obama spoke about the importance of allowing women to thrive in fields of math and science and went after Governor Romney for his awkward answer to that question on pay equality.
I've got to tell you, we don't have to collect a bunch of binders to find qualified, talented, driven young women ready to learn and teach in these fields right now.
Okay, Lisa, now, people have come back later and said, look, when he was governor, it's not that he went out to find women. Women groups came to him with a lot of women, so it wasn't exactly how he portrayed it. But what about the packaging of the governor's comments there? Is that a big deal or not, Lisa?
Well, it was sort of classic Governor Romney. He's known for his what he calls his inelegant phrasing. We've seen that a number of times from him, where things just seem to come out wrong. His advisors know it's something that he's prone to do, and they were really not happy with it and not excited to talk about it with reporters, that's for sure, the next couple of days. But the problem in this case, as you mentioned, wasn't just inelegant phrasing. It was, in fact, that the story wasn't really precisely true. The binder of women that he spoke of was given to him by a women's group that collected a bunch of resumes from qualified women. And in fact, the number of women in government in Massachusetts went down during his administration. So the anecdote was poorly phrased and not quite right. But that being said, the Romney campaign does see themselves making gains among women. There was a 20-point or so gap, according to some polls, earlier in the summer, where the president was leading by that much among women. That's tightened quite a bit as the race has tightened. And they feel like they are making gains with women. This is particularly important because typically President Obama has done better with women than with men. So they really want to cut into the Romney folks really want to cut into his advantage there. And you're seeing them do that in a variety of ways. Governor Romney is talking a lot more on the campaign stump about women in the economy and supporting women entrepreneurs and helping women get jobs and do better in this economy. They also put out an ad, and they've been really doing a push through a lot of different channels to try to clarify his record on abortion. And the ad features a woman who said that she wasn't quite sure where Governor Romney stood on abortion, so she researched it and she found out, it turns out that he doesn't oppose abortion in the case of rape or when the mother's life is in danger. And you saw in the debate, he talked about contraception and how he supports contraception being available to women. That's also not quite right, and a bit of an etch-a-sketch of his what he was saying during the primary when he supported the Blunt Amendment.
And then, Lisa, we've got the Obama ad out there quoting him from some time back saying if Roe v. Wade is overturned, would he sign the legislation to nail that? And he said yes.
Right, that's exactly right. So you're going to see abortion just explode on the campaign trail in the next 2 weeks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about looking at a big week in the news, 18 days now to Election Day. Women front and center on the campaign trail. Bomb plot at the Fed in New York. Lance Armstrong and Liv Strong. Major Garrett of the National Journal is with us from Chicago today. Lisa Lehrer from Bloomberg is with us from Washington. Jack Beatty's here. Major, you say there's four L's that are driving this now. What have you got?
Well, I wrote about this earlier this week, and this was the sum total of conversations with Romney and Obama advisors after the debate and the next morning. And, you know, look, this is not an absolute guidebook for the remainder of the campaign, but broadly speaking, the four L's I identified are proxies for larger topics. One is Libya. That will come up in the foreign policy debate.
Monday night.
The Romney campaign knows and admitted afterwards the governor was less than adroit in his confrontation with President Obama. The Obama campaign thought the president won that confrontation, the dramatic one at the tail end of the second debate. But the Romney campaign is eager to revisit all of Libya at the foreign policy debate, and that will be a broader structural conversation about what to make of and what's the promise and peril for the United States and its allies in this Arab transition, which is looking less and less like a spring and more like just a messy transition. The other one is Ledbetter, which is the Pay Equity Act that the president, the first piece of legislation he signed, a sort of symbol of his outreach to women. That will be a kind of overall descriptor of all these underlying issues, contraception, abortion, pay equity, all these sorts of things that are going to be teased out the remaining 2 weeks. Lying, which is what both campaigns, the other is doing about their records and their future plans, and lame. That's the fourth L, and that is the one the Romney campaign believes is most important. The lame economic performance of the president, so they assert, and the lack and lameness of a description of a second-term agenda if President Obama is reelected. And you saw all those issues come to the fore pretty dramatically and pretty directly right after the debate. So, like I said, that's not a comprehensive list. Other things will arise, but I think in the home stretch, those four L's, broadly speaking, will define a lot of the conversation.
Romney went after the lame piece of that pretty hard on Tuesday night in the debate. Here he is looking with the Romney view of the president's term.
The president has tried, but his policies haven't worked. He's great as a speaker and describing his plans and his vision. That's wonderful, except we have a record to look at. And that record shows he just hasn't been able to cut the deficit, to put in place reforms for Medicare and Social Security, to preserve them, to get us the rising incomes we need. Median incomes down $4,300 a family and 23 million Americans out of work. That's what this election is about.
Jack Beatty, what about, I mean, there's Romney saying, you know, not good on the 4 years. Now, you had one of the citizen questioners in the town hall saying, we understand there was a backdrop to that. And yet, here's the nation looking at another 4 years, looking at the president and Mitt Romney saying, what do you think he's going to do differently?
You know, I think both campaigns, the caricature they have of the other campaign is painfully close to the truth. Romney said the other day that the president was, quote, running on fumes. And that doesn't seem an unfair way to describe it. I mean, really, this second term, so far as we know anything about what the president's going to do, is going to be full of rear guard actions defending things passed in the first term. Health care, clean energy, and so on. But climate change, no. Mention of the moral stakes in the election, that in fact the social safety net for the poorest Americans could be torn up, no. Infrastructure, rebuilding the country, maybe a mention of it. Nothing big. On the other side, I think Bill Clinton is very right when he says about Mr. Romney, quote, he thinks we're dumb. I mean, the sketchy deal, Mr. Obama's phrase for what Romney is offering, really does fit. I mean, repeal and replace Obamacare, but replace it with what? Repeal and replace Wall Street regulation, but with what? Mr. Romney will cut tax rates to 20%, but he won't say how he will pay it. The sketchy deal. It's the running on fumes versus the sketchy deal.
Well, I mean, here's the president. This was Tuesday night, saying, "Look, I've done my best with my commitments, and second term, going to try."
Point is, the commitments I've made, I've kept, and those that I haven't been able to keep, it's not for lack of trying, and we're going to get it done in a second term.
We're going to get it done, and then there's the Romney tax plan. Candy Crowley was pretty tough on that at a certain point with the governor in the Tuesday night's debate. Candy said, "What if the numbers don't add up?" There's been analysis saying they do not. 20% cut in the overall tax rate made up by deductions. Well, analysis saying that won't work. She put that to Governor Romney.
If somehow the numbers don't add up, would you be willing to look again at a 20%?
Well, of course they add up. I was someone who ran businesses for 25 years and balanced the budget. I ran the Olympics and balance the budget. I ran the state of Massachusetts as a governor, to the extent any governor does, and balanced the budget all 4 years.
Of course, the numbers add up, said Governor Romney. The day after, it was President Obama saying, hey, come on, let's look more closely.
Governor Romney also took another stab at trying to sell us his $5 trillion tax cut that favors the wealthy. Once again, he refused to tell us how he's going to pay for it. He said he'd let you know after the election. Now, here's a tip. Usually when a politician tells you he's going to wait until after the election to explain a plan to you, they don't have a pleasant surprise in store for you.
The president the day after. Lisa Lehrer, what about the criticism of the Obama tax, of the Romney tax plan here? Governor Romney goes after Obama for what's he going to do in the second term. President Obama says, well, look at his fundamental plan and it doesn't add up. Is that sticking? Is that selling, Lisa?
Well, I think there are certainly a lot of questions about Governor Romney's tax plan. In order to get a 20% tax cut across the board, which is what he's talking about doing, you would really have to just cut deductions and in a way that just seems politically impossible. For example, the home mortgage interest deduction, people love that. It's very, very popular. You just have to really slash it to get a 20% cut across the board. That doesn't really seem something that's viable. Of course, the Romney campaign has answered and said, well, we're not going to say everything that we're going to do because we want to have negotiating power with Democrats when we get into office. But I think the real problem for the Romney campaign with this whole debate is that it fits into this larger narrative that the Obama folks have been pushing for months and months and months, which is that there are a lot of things you don't know about Governor Romney, and their question constantly has been, what is he hiding? And you've seen that again and again with his Bain investments and, you know, the type of things he did when he was head of that private equity company. They've said that, you know, he's taken jobs offshore and made investments in China and all sorts of things like that, and that he's trying to hide them from the American people. And you're seeing the same thing now with how they're talking about his tax plan. So this is really a larger theme that they've been pushing for the entire campaign, really.
Major, there's a theme there. But what about on the facts? I mean, this tax policy senator that the Obama camp has cited again and again through this campaign came out again this week and said, if you took away every deduction, as I'm reading them here, you still wouldn't come close to covering the $5 trillion in across-the-board tax cut. How is this one playing, Major? And do the numbers add up?
Well, the central problem for the Romney campaign is that they don't actually have numbers. I mean, they don't have numbers other than the 20% and a ever-shifting number that the governor continues to suggest about capping allowable deductions for wealthy American taxpayers. At one time, he said 17,000. That means you total up all your deductions and then cap them, and if over 17,000, you can't take anymore. Then he said at the debate, the second debate, 25,000. He's also said 50,000. But the large numbers, everything sort of in the columns necessary to do all this, including he wants to abolish the alternative minimum tax, the estate tax, all that stuff isn't available. The governor asserts that the math all adds up, but there's no one who can actually look at the math and add it up. But I wrote in my column earlier this week that I think, in addition to avoiding specifics, what the governor has said in broad terms before our very eyes has shrunken the dynamism and scope of whatever he intends to do as far as tax reform, because he said three things repeatedly and with some degree of passion in both debates. The wealthy will not pay less than they're paying now. The middle class will not have their taxes raised, and the deficit will not be increased. Now, I think the governor is saying those three things for two reasons, one political and one governing, should he be elected. He needs to say those things to reassure people nervous about the scope and size and intentions of his tax cut. More importantly, if he wins, he knows that there's no way he can pass through Congress and get an adequate scoring from the Congressional Budget Office sufficient to win the votes he'll need in the House and Senate unless he achieves all three of those objectives. The rich don't get their taxes cut, the middle class don't get hit, and he doesn't increase the deficit. By definition, Tom, those three lodestars minimize the scope and render largely irrelevant talk about a 20% across-the-board tax cut or sweeping away the alternative minimum tax or the estate tax. You can't do those things.
You mean the 20% cut is kind of the foundation stone of what he's describing here.
Well, you're that's what I'm saying. That's why it's so important, because I think before our very eyes, though not directly and not in ways that most savvy listeners can pick up on, but those of us who, like Lisa and I, spend a lot of time covering budgets, the Congressional Budget Office, the scoring mechanisms on Capitol Hill, and how you actually have to make these things work within the confines of a federal budget, can see with those three lodestars, this whole thing is shrinking before our very eyes.
Jack, how does this work out in voters' minds then? I mean, I think people do wonder about this, and a lot of very specific questions being asked on these numbers. Major saying you can't do those three things and have it work out. Okay, that's on one side of the scale. On the other side, you're looking at President Obama, and people may be wondering, like, what exactly is going to be different and better in this second term? That's two big piles of stuff to weigh one against the other, Jack.
Oh, it is indeed. And the imponderables, and, you know, you ask implicitly, how can Romney make think he can get away with such a sketchy proposal?
Well, the president puts it that way.
The president puts it that way, the sketchy deal. And, you know, it, unfortunately, not everybody does pay attention. Studies showed, for example, in 2001, when George W. Bush proposed the biggest tax cut in decades, and what all its effects would be. The election had been about that. You know, this was going to be a big tax cut for the rich and so on. Polls showed that 45% of Americans, while that was being debated, didn't know anything about it. They didn't know anything about it. They didn't know how it would affect them. And I'm terribly afraid that in other words, you can almost say anything, and the lack of empirical support, the lack of even logical consistency, these things don't register. And that gap between what sort of the cognitive end of politics, the policy end, and the rhetorical end, the public doesn't, or large parts of it, doesn't have the leisure to close.
But then they're left with, okay, what do we do here? This has not been an easy 4 years. You know, even among Democrats, there's, oh, where's the Obama enthusiasm now? And then on the other side, you've got these tough questions on Romney, tough questions about what Obama would do in a second term. Ellen in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Ellen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. You know, I'm actually working, but I was in my car and pulled the car over, and I'm just astounded at the amount of, second guessing that's going into what Romney may do and what might not work when we're in the middle of a 4-year debacle. And I don't hear anybody talking about how did we get here and if Obama is reelected, how is he going to get us out of this mess? I mean, we're second-guessing what a president, intended president, or someone who's running, hasn't even done yet. But where is, how is Obama not under the microscope for all the decisions and policies that have not panned out and have not worked? And well, I don't hear that from the media, and I certainly don't hear it on PBS.
Well, Ellen, let us pick it up right here. I mean, I think we're raising quite prominently here the question of what Obama would do with a second term. The question of how we got in this situation, well, that's a big line of history there that goes back before Obama and certainly during Obama. But Lisa, do you think there's comparable scrutiny being given here to the, you know, once in future governor would be president and the sitting president?
Oh, I think there's definitely comparable scrutiny going on, and you see it coming from both sides. I think part of the problem with this election is there's just so much information out there. And in fact, there's more fact-checking than ever before, but it does sort of feel like for a lot of voters that there aren't a lot of facts out there, and there aren't, and you know, the facts are unfair. But I do think that there's comparable scrutiny going on. I think people have really spent the past 6 years delving into the president's record, and really the past 6 years delving into Romney's record. So one of the interesting things about this race is just how long both these men have been in the public eye and just how long both of them have been running. And I think we really do know an awful lot about their backgrounds and what they've done in their various positions.
Let's go to Anne in Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that I would never vote for a candidate who opposed or who tried to make abortion illegal, other than the cases of rape and the health of the mother. I feel that abortion may not be the best solution, but sometimes it's the only solution. And I just wanted to say one more thing, which is I believe in the right for children to have a good life. So there is this right to life issue, but it's also about people, children having a future. So,
what are you thinking when you hear Mitt Romney say, I'm sure he'd say he wants the same thing, and he knows how to provide it, and the president doesn't.
I think that's just such a tall order. I think when it comes to young women or other women who find themselves having a pregnancy that's unwanted, I don't think Romney or our president could do anything to help immediately. And I do believe that sometimes when children are put up for adoption, that the results can be great, but it's just simply that if a young woman or an older woman has an unwanted pregnancy, sometimes they'll just go, if it's not legal, they'll find a way to have one.
You want that available, and we hear it. Anna, I appreciate your call. Major Garrett, the president's certainly talking plenty about Planned Parenthood and abortion this week. How's it cut with women?
Well, two quick points, and I mentioned this when I was doing post-debate analysis on CBS. I've been covering presidential campaigns since 1992, and women have helpfully reminded me through every presidential campaign that women care about all issues, not just quote-unquote, women's issues, point one. Point two, what Jack said earlier is very important. The Romney campaign has always believed that the governor's positions would be problematic for certain women voters in suburban areas in all the swing states, in Virginia, in Ohio, in Iowa, Nevada, etc. But they always believed and still believe strategically that the economy is transcendent, transcends everything, transcends all those other issues. But the Gallup data suggests otherwise, and call suggests otherwise. And one quick point about what Ellen said about the lack of scrutiny from her point of view of President Obama. I think one of the things that's been interesting in this campaign, and it really shifted at that first debate, was the dramatic figure was Romney. He was being treated and viewed almost as if he were the incumbent as opposed to the president. Romney began to shift that in the first debate, and now we're actually having, I think, a much more centralized debate over what Romney intends to do, but also the president's accountability for his own record.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, daredevil Felix Baumgartner jumped from the stratosphere. Mind-blowing to see. It was 24 long miles down to the landing.
And there you can see by the approaching shadow, he's just about there, and he's down on the earth safely.
World record holder.
Live Strong CEO Doug Ullman told NPR that though Lance Armstrong had stepped down as chairman after major doping charges in his bicycling world, he will stay on the Cancer Foundation's board.
As a cancer survivor and someone who came into contact with him years ago in the context of our own diagnoses, he brings that perspective. And I think that perspective is critical to our mission of serving people battling this disease.
In a class of Harlem, fourth graders goes viral with a video takeoff of Carly Rae Jepsen's Call Me Maybe with lyrics changed to Get Out the Vote. We're looking at a week in the news, 18 days to Election Day. Women front and center, bomb plot at the Fed in New York, Lance and Liv Strong, with Major Garrett of the National Journal, White House correspondent there, joining us today from Chicago. Lisa Lehrer from Washington, political reporter for Bloomberg, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Hanover, Sal, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Tom?
Okay, what do you think, Sal?
I'm just thinking that they're just making too big of a deal, you know, in this binder thing, you know, because he needed some qualified people, and the women's group brought him that binder. You know, a lot of people use binders.
So what? Forgive and forget here. Not important language. Just what about the – why do you think there's such an uproar over it then, at least a buzz on the Internet about itself?
I think that they just, you know, will use anything they can, you know, to make an uproar, you know, to like divide the country, you know, to turn people against Romney. And I think that, you know, they just use anything they can.
Yeah, whatever it takes. Well, everything gets picked up at this point in a race, I guess. But clearly some people looking at that and wondering. Sal, thanks. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a good hardline proponent of affirmative action, but I know the Republican Party. To the Republican Party, that's anathema. If Mitt Romney actually did what he said he did, reaching out, telling his staff to go find some women, that epitomizes affirmative action. In fact, women are the greatest recipients of affirmative action. They always have been. And I just don't understand how Republicans can revile affirmative action and then Mitt Romney can say he engaged in it.
So you're calling him out on affirmative action from that direction? Women as the greatest recipients? I don't know about that. You may get some binder pushback on that as well, but it was interesting. I mean, Jack, you recall Mitt Romney was in a tough spot when he was running for governor there because he had, within the Republican Party in Massachusetts, he had pushed aside an acting governor, female, Jane Swift, to make himself the man, as it were. And even some in the Republican Party weren't so happy about that.
That's right. You know, he's now got women he appointed to high places traveling around the country, a team of them testifying to his reach in the binder field, and that he was good for women in that regard. But you know, yeah, what struck me in the debate that came out was he denied that he essentially supported this Blunt Amendment, this Roy Blunt, the senator from Missouri, who came up with an amendment that basically would allow employers to say that their employees could not have that the insurance companies would not cover contraception on moral grounds. In other words, not even religious grounds. I just don't approve of contraception. Our insurance plan won't cover it. Those are the terms of our employment. Mr. Romney embraced that. He said he was for that. And in the debate, he denied that he was. And I think that's I'm sure we're going to hear more about that from the president.
Well, it seems no end to what we'll hear about women at this point in the race with the numbers the way they are. Craig in Aiken, South Carolina. Craig, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
First off, I don't think Obama is the best leader on the planet, but however, I voted for him and I will do it again. Secondly, is anytime we talk about the debt and this huge debt that we keep throwing around, $14 to $16 trillion,
yep.
Anytime someone mentions that, they ought to say right off the bat that the GOP owns more than half of it. So just stop right there, okay? And the third thing is, Obama's tried a couple of things, roads, teachers, firemen, these kind of things, and we always get blocked. If he said the world was round, the GOP says, no, it's square. So let's just stop this and try to work together to solve some problem.
Craig, I think you speak for a lot of people right there, though they might not all come down the way it sounds like you're coming down. I mean, Major, at this point, is this just an issue of tweaking out these margins in that handful of states, as you say? Or is it still about going at the heart of Americans' concern about the future and who might have a better handle on it?
Here's what we know, Tom. The third and final debate Monday will be the last chance for an overall speaking to the nation closing statement for the challenger and the incumbent. And after that, there will be campaign rallies in specific states and then the machinery of get-out-the-vote efforts for both campaigns. And I will tell you, both presidential campaigns will admit this privately, because every presidential campaign I've ever covered admits this privately. 1 week out, it's basically over. There's no new messaging. There's no new commercials being purchased. Everything that you've got rolling is what you've got rolling. And everything from that point forward, a week out, if not more, maybe 10 days out, is all about the mechanism of your voter contacts and your voter persuasion and your voter mobilization. That's what the whole thing is about. And also, remember this, Tom, we're voting now. The election is happening right now. 31% of our country, 79% in Colorado in 2008, voted before Election Day. That number, that percentage, rather, could be as high as 35%. Some political scientists think it could be as high as 40%. And the Obama campaign feels very good about the early vote it's banked in places like Ohio and Iowa, elsewhere. Republicans feel similarly upbeat compared to 2008. But they ought to, because they had almost no early vote mobilization in 2008 to speak of at all. So Monday's the last big night for a national commentary and closing statement. Then we have about a week of more advertising and things like that. And then the last week is basically the existing message, the existing optics, and the machine behind it.
Lisa, the Republican enthusiasm has been polling higher through much of this race. What about that at this point? Do they still have that energy edge?
Well, if anything, I think that we've seen that Republican enthusiasm has gone up since the first debate. And you're seeing it on the campaign trail. You know, I travel a lot with Romney. And when I was traveling with him most recently, right before the second debate, you saw bigger crowds. I mean, he had several crowds over 10,000, which is not a ton for President Obama, who routinely gets very large crowds, but is quite a big shift for Governor Romney, who hasn't seen that size. And people are excited, and they're excited to go out and vote for him. And they're really counting on turning out the base in places like Southwest Ohio and many of these pivotal battleground states in big numbers. So that's something that you've seen the Romney campaign working to do, particularly in some of their messaging on coal. That's really targeted at Republican voters in Midwestern states that they just want to get out there and force.
Steve in Woodbury, Vermont. Steve, thanks. You're on the air.
Yes, great show, Tom. My point is that I believe the interest in Romney's campaign, the Republican platform now, especially in this election, is more the pace of change, not so much a vision or the direction. If you look at some of the empirical standards, we seem to be actually improving. Housing, Wall Street, employment, trade imbalance, energy dependence, even social equity issues, women's pay, access to health care. Some of these are debatable on the social side, of course, but medical insurance. The American public, I believe, has been grown accustomed to instant gratification, and this is not so much a vision issue as it is just the pace.
Well, Steve, you're a very patient guy. I mean, instant gratification, it has been years now of really lousy economic situation. You can argue all day about where responsibility lies at this point, but it's been a long time.
Sure it has, but you know, Romney was charged with cleaning up a mess, and now he's being faulted for dragging a smelly barrel through the alley. I mean, we're going in the right direction. People have lost their patience in this age. We're talking about a larger issue there are great merits attributed to the greatest generation, those who have sacrificed for wars. God bless those men and women that are still sacrificing.
Yeah, Steve, I think we got it. Let me take it to you, Major Garrett, if I may. And this is, in a way, part of what the president, I heard him saying, you know, be patient. You know, it may not be quick, but we're going for the investments that will turn us around over the long term. How do you think that's playing, Major?
Well, the president is all about a gentle trajectory upward, not a dramatically rising one. He can't assert that. He knows it's not true.
He doesn't have it.
He doesn't have it. And what you saw in the second debate was a very poignant moment where that African-American gentleman stood up and said to the president, I voted for you. I was enthusiastic. I'm not enthusiastic anymore. I wonder what you can tell me. Tell me to vote for you.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
That's a central question of this campaign. And the Romney campaign believed that Governor Romney's response there was the best he's ever had, the most tight and precise articulation of what's wrong with the president's policies, why the trajectory is not helpful, it's not encouraging, and that we need to make a structural change. But I will tell you, in presidential races and more similarly in gubernatorial races, which is the closest thing that's not a presidential race to a chief executive race we have in this country, political scientists have done a ton of research about this, and incumbents in troubled times who prevail on a gently upward trajectory argument. And people who believe that things, though not great, are getting better, tend to stick with the incumbent. That's one of the things internally the Obama campaign is relying upon.
Boy, it's such a close call about how and whether things are getting better, because you can find numbers that certainly point the other way. And Governor Romney happy to roll out a lot of big numbers the other day about jobs lost and so on. I want to turn abroad just a little bit. Foreign policy and Libby and Benghazi came into that debate on Tuesday night. Jack, how did you think that ultimately ended up? There was that big kind of gotcha moment that Governor Romney ended up putting himself in, where the president said, well, I did call it terror on the second day after. Candy Crowley came in and supported him. Fox News didn't like that, people on all sides. But what about the facts of what happened in Benghazi? Do they matter here, Jack, at this point?
Well, I don't know whether we're going to get a coherent account of them. I mean, the New York Times reporting this week did bring in the video. Now, remember, the video was even dropped by our government. They said the video didn't have anything to do with it. It was a terrorist attack. Well, according to David Kirkpatrick, no. He talked, in fact, to one of the leading members of the group that Ansar al-Sharia, the group that attacked the consulate. And this fellow said, yep, we saw that video. And we decided we're going to strike the consulate, so that the video did, in fact, play a role in not in starting a demonstration. That was the initial claim the administration made, but rather in igniting this terrorist group, this group of jihadis to strike. So that seemed to be the new factual turn here.
We still have that image of Susan Rice at the UN, you know, talking about the demonstration,
yes.
And that was left to linger for a long time.
Yes, and now there's a report that the CIA, the day after the Associated Press reports that the day after the attack, the CIA got a message saying there was no demonstration. So I'm sure this is going to be gone into thoroughly. And the president, of course, when he turned to Mr. Romney and he said, how dare you? How dare you ever suggest that we would cover up? Well, I'm sorry. The governments cover up all the time. That's what they do. And that righteous moment may have helped him. But if you think about it for a minute, you have to go on the assumption that a government will cover up anything in an election season that can discredit them.
A big bomb blast in Beirut today, next door to Syria, where things have been so bloody and difficult. And now, just chaos in Beirut, Lebanon, this morning. We don't have a claim of authorship of that blast yet. But Lisa, in this foreign policy debate on Monday night, no doubt Governor Romney again will say, look at this arc of upheaval, and the president's not holding it together in foreign policy.
Oh, there's no doubt. And although Governor Romney sort of botched his attack on the president's handling of the situation and the attack in Libya, you know, during the second presidential debate, he sort of got, as we were saying before, mirrored in this debate over semantics and what exactly did he say act of terror, or terrorist attack. The Romney campaign Republicans still see foreign policy as a really strong issue for them, which is a really interesting thing, because for a long time, President Obama had a very strong approval ratings in foreign policy. You know, he ended the war in Iraq and he killed Osama bin Laden. These were pretty big notches on his resume. And it was and something that's traditionally been a Republican strength. But since the attack on the mission in Libya and the demonstrations across the Middle East, we've seen Romney begin to catch up on his numbers in foreign policy. And there was a Pew poll this week that showed them Romney just 4 points behind President Obama on foreign policy issues and who can do a better job making good decisions about foreign policy. So that's a lot of gains for Governor Romney and the Republicans. So they really do see this as an issue that they can just hammer President Obama over in a place where they can pick up a little support, especially given that the economic picture has for a lot of people improved. Home values are up. The stock market is up. So for a lot of people, the economy doesn't feel quite as bad as it did. It's still a slow recovery, but this is another way for them to make their argument.
Mitch Garrett, Arlen Specter, died this week at 82, 30 years, U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, played the middle like nobody's business. Will we ever see that kind of role again, Major?
I don't know. Arlen Specter was a complicated figure. He was briefly a presidential candidate running strictly to uphold what remained of the pro-choice wing of the Republican Party. His platform and his candidacy evaporated rapidly. He was a huge advocate of federally funded scientific research. Yet he was also the number one prosecutor against Anita Hill in a seminal moment that transformed gender politics in this country. So Arlen Specter has a long and sweeping career and did in the Senate. Many testimonials to him this week of laudable character, complicated figure, a moderate Republican of his stripe. I don't think we'll see as prominent as he was in the latter parts of his career for a long, long time.
Well, here we go. Home stretch to a big presidential election. Very grateful for your insights today. Major Garrett with National Journal joining us today from Chicago. Thank you so much, Major.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Lisa Lehrer with Bloomberg, political reporter there out of Washington today. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It was fun.
Jack Beatty, thanks so much. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.